This episode features true and unfiltered graphic and traumatic events. Viewer discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Atwell Podcast.
Mr. Williams, I really appreciate you, and welcome to the Atwell Podcast. I was reading through your story a little bit on the directory, and obviously 26 years in law enforcement, you've bound to have 50 years worth of stories to tell.
A few, yeah.
Awesome. And you dealt with some PTSD, so can you tell me a little bit about maybe your background, what led to the PTSD, and then we can just go more or less organically from there?
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, I spent 26 years as a police officer, detective, and I saw a lot of things during that time that most people don't want to see.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, back then we bottled it up. We didn't talk about it to anybody. And that's what I did. That's how I learned. I'm a guy. I got this. I don't need any help. And if we asked for help, we would get let go, be found unfit for duty.
And really?
Back then, yeah. And so I bottled it up and I ended up divorced, bankrupt, lost everything. Because I didn't talk about it, I quit sharing with my wife. I let the job become my life. I put the job over everything else to take care of my community. And I made that more important than my family, which was a big mistake.
Yeah.
And then I later on started having nightmares. You know, I was having probably 3, 4, 5 nightmares a month. And then I just kind of moved on through that process, and it took me a while. But towards the end of my career, I finally started reaching out to some people. I you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. And
sure.
I got married again, ended up divorced there. You know, and I was married 19 years the first time, 13 the second time. And so it's not like I'm not a quitter. I don't know.
I don't know
how. But I ended up living at my cabin by myself for 3 years. And I, after the second divorce, and I got back in touch with who I really am. I got back in touch with nature, spiritual things, and all the things that I needed to develop to get back to the being who I am and not being the cop. I let the job become my life.
Yeah. So I guess one of my first questions, just off the top of my head, is what exactly led to the PTSD? Was it a number of different things, or was it one huge event?
No, there was numerous events. You know, I had a car trying to run me down while I'm pulling the trigger at the driver's forehead, pulling a child on, doing CPR, and not being able to bring them back. You know, going through a door when shots are being fired. Just things that we see as an everyday cop are just, like say, what people don't want to see. We get to see people having good people having a really bad day, or bad people. We don't deal with people in a great, happy environment.
So what area are you in during this time? What area are you serving?
I was in a suburb of Salt Lake City, Utah. About 150,000 people in the city, and we had 120. Well, when I started, we had about an 80-person department. And by the time I retired, it was 120 officers. So it was,
and I'm guessing that the reason for that is obviously if there's a need for more officers, it's probably because there's more crime happening over the course of your career.
Well, that, but also the city went from probably 90,000 people to 150, growing that fast.
Yeah. And so population.
The more people you have, the more crime you have, the more officers you need.
And you mentioned that there was pretty much, I think you mentioned 3 or 4 major events there. Do you think any of those events help, or how do I word this? Do you think any of those events affected your thought processes on dealing with other more smaller crimes?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the one thing I learned during my healing process is I could blame a lot of things on PTSD because I made some really bad decisions. Did PTSD influence those decisions? Yes. But it was my choice to make that decision. And so I have to be self-accountable. And that's one thing I'm really big on now is self-accountability. There are no excuses. You know, there's just simply choices. And I made choices that did not work back then. A lot of behaviors are very common with people that I displayed are common with people with PTSD. You know, my son got blown up in Afghanistan. And he lived, but he spent 4 years at Walter Reed, had 40 some odd surgeries so he could sort of walk again. 20 years old, you know. And his life has completely changed. And he and I talk a lot about PTSD. And his experiences for PTSD, he was in two firefights a day for several months. And he almost got blown up twice with the rockets. And then on his way out, one of his buddies stepped on an IED, and that's where they got injured. And so those are horrific experiences. Me, like say the car, going through the door, seeing, you know, I used to have to help pick up body parts when I worked for transit police for 6 years, and going investigating those crimes, those scenes, and just the slow over time of everything adding up, finding something went. I don't know what, how it works. But, you know, but then you take my experiences. But then you have the 40-year-old lady down the street, and she watches, she's had her dog for 20 years, and she watched her dog get hit by a car. It's like her kid. So now we've all three got traumatic events. Whose PTSD is worse? That's the question we talked about. Well, there is no worse. PTSD is PTSD, and the end result's the same. The inciting events may be more dramatic in my son's and my case. But the end result is the same, and so we have to work through those things. And that's where I finally have come to now in my life, is helping others work through and offering suggestions, especially cops. That's what I relate to.
I got a couple stories I'd like to share with you that sort of correlate with what you're saying. So speaking about the Afghanistan thing, I was not in the military. However, I did go to a military school for high school and something called the Mountaineer Challenge Academy, where basically you stay on a military base for 6 months to get your diploma. And as a 16 to 19-year-old boy, so one of the first questions that you sort of ask is, did you see anybody die? Did you kill anybody? It's just a very common question that you ask because everybody there is in the military that's over you. So it's kind of a immature question to ask, but we did ask that question. And there was a guy who was a CDL driver, a cadre, they called it. And this guy told a story to us that I'll never forget as long as I live. He was one of the first people over in Afghanistan. And he said to us verbatim, I'll never forget it. He said that they were instructed that anyone that had anything bigger than a rock in their hand in those early days to shoot them.
Wow.
So the things that people went through in Afghanistan is the full story, the full scope of it may never be told, but I really appreciated you sharing your son's story. One other story I want to provide that's really going to correlate more to the PTSD and your story, especially your son's story, is we had a family member. I won't disclose this name because I don't have permission, but we had a family member who actually was a Purple Heart recipient. And he got shot out of a helicopter and he survived. So naturally he gets honorably discharged and he has some physical, you know, ailments, things that happened to him. He's dealing with PTSD, and then he also has physical things going on with him. So they prescribe him pain pills, opioids. So he's dealing with PTSD and now a drug addiction. And his family completely abandoned him. They basically say, you're on drugs. I don't want nothing to do with you.
Wow.
He ends up taking his own life. And I think that how you started this podcast episode, you said something that is really tugging at my heart because you said that you was afraid to seek help because you'd be looked at sorely, I guess. I don't have the right words, but for men, we deal with pride a lot. And some of those people that get on drugs, they need our help. They don't need our judgment. They need our help. So I just thought you would find those two stories interesting.
Well, and I like that because they don't need judgment, and we as a society are trained from this little kids to judge, and we don't even realize it. That's why I don't even use the terms right and wrong anymore. Because what's right for me may not be right for you. What's wrong for me may not be wrong for you. And so I use the terms, does it work? It works or it doesn't work, because then I'm simply looking at the result of the action, and there is
Result
no
of the
judgment.
action.
The result of what they did, and that's there's no judgment. And so it either works or it doesn't work. And so I've changed a lot of my terminology over the years, as I've discovered things, and I that helps me keep a clear, open, straight look. Instead of shading it with my view.
One thing that I was sort of surprised about your story, and I actually have a very recent story here locally that will correlate to this pretty big, is that you said that you had basically went into isolation into a cabin for 3 years, right? And was that after your first marriage or your second marriage?
Was after the second marriage, and I still went to work every day, but I drove 57 miles to work. And that allowed me to, and I went through the whole process. I was a good guy, but I went home and I started drinking. Now, I didn't drink too much. I mean, I only drank two drinks a night, but they were 34 ounces each. So yeah, so I was not feeling any pain, and I wasn't having nightmares because I was numb. And then I woke up one morning. And I'm standing at the kitchen sink, looking out the window at the deer out the in the woods outside my cabin. And I saw my reflection in the window, and I kind of looked at myself. I went, "Man, what are you doing? The only life you're destroying is you." And then I started going. I changed habits. Instead of, I'd get up at 3:30 in the morning to go to work, and I'd work until 4 in the afternoon if there was no overtime. And there was a lot of overtime. So sometimes I worked till 5 or 6. I'd work, 10, 12 hour, 10 hours minimum, and often 12 to 13. And then by the time I got home at 7 at night, it was like exhausted. And I got in the habit of sitting in front of the TV and doing nothing and pouring a drink and making dinner and pouring a drink and just sitting there numbing myself all night until I finally went to bed. And so between exhaustion, between, I think there may have been some depression in there because I didn't want to be divorced again. I looked at myself as a two-time loser because that's not the way I was raised. I didn't want that. In reality, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. So,
Really?
oh yeah, it was. I wrote a book, and it's all in my book. But some of the things that I discovered after the fact, and as I was going through that, I should not have even wanted to be in that relationship anymore. But
One
I have
thing,
a hard time quitting, so.
One thing that really is interesting about being in the isolation for 3 years is a lot of times isolation makes things a lot worse, right?
Oh yeah, it can, and I'm fortunate that like I said, I went to work every day, so I wasn't totally isolated. On my days off, I did my normal shopping and stuff, but yeah, isolation can definitely make things worse, and that's one of the things. My big thing is communication and relationships. Communication, relationships are key to life, and communication is the only thing that drives those relationships. So you have to have an open, honest relationship. And I got very lucky after going through a lot of this. I met another lady, and I'm married now. We've been together now 10 years, and I have you know, we have our issues, but we have a great relationship because I have zero secrets from my wife. She knows everything, and I know everything about her. And we just share and we work through stuff. And it's possible to do that. But we have to change ourselves. The change starts with us. That's what.
My wife and I have been together for 14 years. We got together as teenagers, both from very extreme impoverished backgrounds. And when it comes to marital stuff, a pastor by the name of Kenny Baker told me something that changed my life, and I'll share it with you because I think it's just great advice for anyone who listen. And he told me, he said, Randy, he said, you are going to be responsible for every decision in your household. Now, this might come off as toxic masculinity to some. I get that, but it's worked for me for 14 years. So anyway, the thing that was is that when you realize that you are responsible, you take every decision that you're making to heart because you realize, for me, what I believe personally is that I will stand in front of my maker one day and answer for those choices that I make as it pertains to my household and my own life. So with that being said, it has led to an extremely good marriage. And I honestly, to God, do not know where I would be at without my wife. You know, she is my rock for everything, you know. And a couple years ago, you know, she got diagnosed with this really, really rare type of cancer, and it sort of sent us shockwaves. But at the end of it, we actually have a stronger relationship than what we did prior. So some of that trauma stuff can lead to good, some of it can lead to bad. I got so many questions that
It gives you the opportunity to choose whether it's good or bad.
That's
And
good.
because every second in life, every day is a choice. And what we choose is how the direction that we go. And I'm very positive minded because I believe a positive mindset will guide us in the correct, in a direction that works. The world is so negative based right now. Everything's fear, 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 and it's like you can't live your life in fear. I lived my life in fear as a cop, fear of doing the wrong thing, fear of saying the wrong thing, fear of letting somebody down. Nothing physically, but those were the fears that I had. And because of that, I tempered things that I would say, or how I dealt with supervisors, or how I dealt with other people in the department. And I forgot who I was because I wasn't open and honest with them or with myself.
It's really interesting that you said something a minute ago about communication and relationships are key. And I'll tell you the reason why. I'm working on a larger project as it relates to poverty. And I'm dealing with the world-renowned expert on poverty, Dr. Ruby Payne. And we actually have something coming up on Friday, and then we have some other stuff planned a little later on. But her big thing is relationships. I'm also a business major in college, where again, it just comes down to relationships over and over and over again. So the fact that you in a totally different related field brought that up is going to make me think a lot for the rest of the day.
Okay. And the most important relationship is the one you have with yourself.
I'm gonna write that down actually. For yourself. I guess when you look at yourself in the mirror, you're the one who has to make the choice on what you do with your life. And sometimes it takes a extreme negative thing to happen to sort of break who you was before, and that break is needed. And it sounds like, if I'm not reaching here, that sort of happened to you, not just one time, but a couple different times.
Well, yeah, because I kept making the same choices.
Mm-hmm.
I kept making the same choices. And I'm a slow learner. But man, now that I've finally learned, now my life is amazing. I wrote a book. I have another book that's at the editor right now that two publishers want. I discovered I'm actually a good writer. And the first one's nonfiction, but then the next ones are fictions. And I got a whole series planned. And so I get to go do those things. And I love traveling and I love meeting people. And I go out and talk to police departments. And I talk to military people and hospitals because the trauma that the people witness, it goes back when I was in the academy, they had our spouses come in with us. And they said, the divorce rate in law enforcement is really high. So there's a good chance you guys could end up divorced. And we sat here for 4 hours for this class. And through the whole thing, they're going on about, got to keep communication up with your spouse, but there's things you aren't going to be able to talk about because it may be an ongoing investigation or it just might be too gruesome that you don't want to talk about it. And he said, but keep communication open with your spouse so you don't get divorced. And we walked out, 30 of us walked out going, and. But it took me 25 years and I came up with the and. And that's one of the things I talk about with communication is how to rephrase a traumatic event so it can be safely shared with others because it's going to remain a traumatic event until you share it and get it out there. So like I can go home and share with my spouse now without blowing her mind. If I were, I would, I highly recommend people talk, whether it be clergy or whether it be a counselor or a therapist, which now that's okay. But when I was an officer in 1992, it wasn't okay. And, it was the things that, if you don't talk about it, it's going to eat you alive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My dad actually, not to be super traumatic and dramatic, but my dad, when I was about 15, he actually committed suicide and left behind myself and my two younger sisters. Obviously, that is an extreme event, but partially of that is because of the stigma about guys just asking for help and talking. And actually, I'm not sponsored by these people whatsoever. I have no monetization whatsoever going on, but there's something going on now called BetterHelp, or some of the telehelp things that we have in this new world. I highly doubt they existed in the 90s, but now you're able to seek professional help
Yeah, there are a ton
and
of
get that help
resources.
anonymously.
So yeah, that's so important now. People are starting to realize, but think about this. Everybody has trauma in their life. And so you got cops that are in trauma, probably making not making super great decisions, but doing the best they can dealing with citizens that are in trauma. And we wonder why there's problems.
I have one of the most extreme stories that is from a sheriff here locally in Greenbrier County. A couple years back, this girl, this is going to be really dramatic. This girl had unalived her five children. And she set the house on fire. And to make this even more dramatic, a couple of them had already been deceased while the others were waiting to get off the school bus. So essentially, she was sitting in the house with her children that was no longer living, waiting for her other children to get off the bus to do it. Now, how this relates to law enforcement, I'll get to in a second. So she writes a letter. She takes her own life. But here's one of the craziest things I've ever witnessed in my life. The sheriff of the county, because it's a, we're a small county, we're in West Virginia, so everybody knows everybody. Everybody's asking. There's a lot of political pressure behind something of this magnitude locally. And the sheriff goes up live on television, takes this note and reads it to the entire county verbatim without, and it was one of the craziest things. I'm not even sure if I agreed with it 100%, but the fact that he did it so transparently gave me such a different respect for law enforcement and what they had to deal with. And that guy, I mean, if he would have came to that scene and said, "You know what? I've got to retire. I can no longer deal with this no more." You wouldn't have judged him at all.
No, those are the things that affect officers for the rest of their life. And those are the ones that wake you up at night.
No one woke us up. I mean, I almost had some kind of experience myself just from hearing the letter being read, because me and that girl wasn't romantic together at all, but we had at one point in our lives flirted back and forth a little bit.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what snapped in her head
Yeah.
that made that happen, you know? And again, she was totally the area that she was in. She was living in a county, no cell phone service, no internet, totally isolated. There are some extremely bad things that can happen in that isolation.
Yeah.
Extremely bad things. The fact that you were able to go in there and fight that isolation yourself, I know you had some social at work, but the fact that you were able to fight that isolation, living in your own head with no wife, I'm assuming at the time, from the time frame that your children wasn't living at home at that
Nope.
time, that is pretty extreme. That is pretty extreme. So can you tell me what that thought process is in that isolation? I know that you were drinking a little bit, maybe you don't remember all of it, but was there something that was just like the aha moment during that time, like maybe a breakdown or something along those lines?
Well, I started seeing things at work. I had retired from one department and went to transit police, and I started seeing things at work, and I was having a very successful career at transit police, and was one of the go-getters and the up-and-comers, you know. And one, in fact, it's I titled it Dr. Death in my book. Was on, I think it was four or five people hit by trains in like 2 or 3 weeks. And every one of them was in my area. So when I came to work, everybody knew something was going to happen. And it seemed like those always happened in my area for about a month there. And the transit system's huge. I mean, it runs, man, 80 miles north and south and 20 miles east and west or more.
Those deaths are not pretty, I imagine.
No,
Getting
they're
hit by
terrible.
a train, that's pretty terrible.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, and I
Golly,
ended
man.
up getting all those, and then as I got home, that's when I kind of started thinking, "Oh man, I don't. Please, no more." That's what I said. I said, "Please, no more." And that kind of woke me up, and then I started realizing I actually. It's kind of funny. I had pretty good leaders at that time, and they knew stuff that was going on, and they were out there with us and doing the stuff, and so they actually allowed us to talk back and forth with each other, and that's one of the things. I mean, who do you talk to if you need to talk? You got your friends, you got your family, you got your coworkers if you can. At the first department, I didn't have that relationship with my coworkers. In fact, I was there 18. I worked there 20 years. On my 18th year, it was when I had to pull a child out of the pond and do CPR and couldn't save him. And that was the first time in my career, 18 years, that one of the lieutenants came up to me and he says, "Are you okay, brother?" First time I ever got asked if I was okay. And yeah, I looked at him, and this was the first time he allowed me to be open and honest because he was open and honest. And because of that, I was able to look at him and say, "No, I'm not." And and he was a gracious guy. He says, "You got your reports and stuff due, but," he says, "go take care of yourself for a while and then come back in the office and finish your reports." And I went and sat in a parking lot of a church and cried for an hour in my car by myself. I just, because we had searched and done everything we could, and we couldn't save him.
Do they allow you to have any kind of mental health like administrative leave during that time, like your law enforcement time? Like when you experience something like that, in other words, are they like, hey, listen, like you're probably not fit mentally for work for about a week
Yeah.
or whatever?
At that time, no. They didn't have anything at that time, but now they do. And that fact, right at that time, that was about the time they were starting to bring some things in. We didn't have peer support at the time. They do, most departments have it now. They do have a mental health, you can go see a counselor through the city insurance, things like that. And that came in. And that was about the time some of that was coming in. But a lot of people didn't trust it. It's like I tell departments now, if you're going to have a mental health counselor, a lot of them actually have their own in-house person now. And I tell them, I said, if you're going to have that now, I've seen some departments where the mental health person's office is right next to the chief's office. So if anybody goes in there, it's not anonymous. And so they've got to separate that out. And they've done a pretty good job for the most part on that. So now, yeah, there's a lot more of those resources that we did not have back then. So yeah, and that's one of the things I would say, go talk to somebody. And I used a lot of outside the box ways. I went and stopped, I went and talked to a counselor on my own dime. I didn't want anybody knowing. And that's what I started with. That was one that I had a gun pulled on me and jammed into my chest and then was shot next to my head. And that one, I went and talked to a counselor on that. And those are things that it took me a while to realize. My response was self-defense, and I broke the person's jaw when I hit them. And it took me a while to really work through some of that. It's so yeah, I talked to those people, and counselors are awesome if you find the right one that fits you. I've had some that I kind of, eh, I'm not coming back here.
Two thoughts here. When my dad passed away, as I was talking about earlier, they sort of forced me. Me and my dad didn't really have a great relationship, but he's still my dad, right? And they sort of forced me to go and see a psychiatrist. And I did not trust him at all. One of the big things for me, what I experienced, and again, it's nothing nearly as traumatic as what you did, but just, maybe some of the psychological will correlate here. One of the things that I experienced was the reason I didn't trust it is because I didn't feel like they could relate to what I had been through in my life. I'm looking at this guy, he's got a suit on, he's super, educated and nice, and he grew up rich or whatever, middle class income. I'm just this poor kid who just went through something traumatic. And I don't trust him because I don't feel like there's any life experience intertwined. He couldn't relate to me. So maybe that's something that the law enforcement people would have. It's like, how can you help me if you never went through anything, but I just went through such and such murder scene or such and such serial crime scene?
And I'm really happy to find out that there's a lot of people that are former cops that are becoming counselors. And for cops, that's great because they do and can relate. And there's people like me that, yeah, I've walked the walk. I'm not a doctor, never played one on TV, but I survived because of things that I've learned. And if I can share those things, then I can get that out there with people. And even military, I was never in the military, but there's not a whole lot of differences. There's a lot of differences, but there's a lot of similarities between law enforcement and military. And the fact that two of my kids were in the army, the one was in Afghanistan, the other one was in Iraq. And I have a lot of military in my family. So I can kind of relate to a few things there, and I wouldn't even try to relate to combat in an actual shooting war because I can't relate to that. But
But when you're looking at colleagues going through trouble, it's a military term. Military members talk about a lot, and that is trauma bonding.
yeah.
So where you was talking about with your law enforcement guys, that guy that came up to you and was basically saying, "Are you okay?" He was kind of dealing with some trauma too. He may not have been as firsthand as you was, but he's still looking at a dead child, right? So he's still dealing with some trouble
Well, and
there.
he had been there for 17 years. So he'd been on the street. He knew everything, you know, and he'd been through it. And I knew that. In fact, he's one of the ones, I don't keep in touch with a lot of the people I work with anymore, but he's one of them I do, even though he lives in another state now. We talk, you know, a couple times a month.
I don't know that guy, but thank God that he helped you out because that was really nice of him. And for it to take so long for someone to reach out, it's kind of crazy to me. But at the same time, when you're looking at the time frames, I know for me, I'm 33 years old. I know how much the world has changed just in my short life. So for you in law enforcement, when you're talking about people in the 90s not allowing you to basically talk about your trauma or it being kind of looked down upon, I definitely understand that. Would you mind telling me a little bit more about your book? I'm actually planning on buying it, by the way. I really like, so if you can find like if you got like a website or something, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I would like to buy it. And one thing, when I have guests on, I like to see if I can get a signed copy. I got like a crazy collection, so we might talk about that a little later. But I'll give you the floor to talk about that book.
Okay. Well, I actually have a copy here, Bridging the Gap, an inside look at communication relations after traumatic events, and it's on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and a couple others. And it basically goes through the things that I experienced in my career and how I did not deal with them very well back then. And I talk about my relationships and how I destroyed those. And, you know, there were things on both sides. There always is. But I get to look at it self-accountably so I can talk about what I did or didn't do that created the problems and how I would do them differently now. And then I talk about the communication, how to share a traumatic event in there without traumatizing your partner. Because that's the most important thing with your partner is communication. And they've got to know it's open and honest. Now, I can change the terminology and things and still be open and honest. Temper it down just a little bit so that it can be shared. But the most important thing for me is to, in the communication with my spouse, is to share how I feel. Which, you know, I grew up as you're a guy, you don't need help. You know, it you've got this. And we didn't share feelings. And that was, man. And it's not like I get all, you know, feel good, kumbaya stuff, but if something bugs me, I tell my wife. If it's something she's doing that's bugging me, I tell her, politely, nicely, with love. But those are things I never did in the past, and I used to just let those build up and eat at me.
I have a question that I guess I should have asked earlier before you got into the book, but for some reason it just popped up. Did you deal with any anger issues from the PTSD? Did you have outbursts at home or anything like that?
Yes, I did. And that's very common. I'd snap and then I'd go, oh, but it was an automatic snap. And then I'd kind of back off going, oh, you know, and I screwed that up. And with my kids, man, that was hard because that's hard on them. And unfortunately, that's kind of common with people with PTSD. And that's a great excuse that's PTSD, but it's still my choice. And so now I'm much calmer, I'm much easier, you know, and I go through things. I still have some processes I go through to keep myself even keel. And, you know, it's kind of funny. And the funny thing, not funny, but PTSD never goes away. It's always there lurking. I actually got down to where I was only having one or two nightmares a year. And then I have a service dog, and I was at the Denver airport, which I'd been to 7 or 8, 9 times, and he was misbehaving, and I wasn't properly equipped. I had his tools packed in my check-on luggage, and which I don't normally do, but there's some weird things happened that day. And so I submitted him to get him to calm down. And then this lady just started yelling and screaming at me. She thought I was abusing my dog. And in fact, I thought I was being attacked. She came charging up on me and I swung my arm around like, get back. And I went into cop mode. Get back, get away from me. And then she kept yelling and screaming. And it was so bad that my wife was in the restroom, heard her. She came out. My wife's Miss Calm. And she's trying to calm her down. This gal just would not stop. And all of a sudden, I got 20 or 30 people around me. And I went into a total gray, black zone where I couldn't see anything. And I just got up and left with my dog. I don't know what happened. My wife was still there. And I wandered around the airport looking for the dog leaf room. That's where I was headed. And I'd been there 7 or 8 times before. I knew where it was. But I was lost for an hour. I don't remember a thing for that hour. And I finally got him to the room and then I got down and I could not explain it to my wife. I could not explain what happened because it was so weird. But then I had nightmares 4 nights in a row.
It sounds like almost like a, if I, for lack of a better word, a hallucinogenic episode almost.
Almost, yeah. It triggered me bad. I finally used some of the things that I've learned on the fourth day. I love nature. Nature's a big healing thing for me and a lot of people. And I went up in the mountains. I got some good physical exercise. I was standing on a mountain peak overlooking a valley, and after that, the nightmares went. And then the funny thing is, I didn't have another nightmare for almost a year.
When you started getting off of all this and you started seeking like professional help and things of this nature, did medication at all, was it at all involved?
No, there's a lot of things that are good, like people like ketamine treatment. My son liked that, but I worked part-time narcotics for a while, and I just will not. excuse me. I had two shoulder surgeries, and during that time, I took one oxycodone, and I didn't like the way it made me feel, and that was it. And I don't trust that stuff.
You wouldn't believe this, but my wife, like I said, she just she dealt with some cancer last week or week before. She had her permanent implants put in, and they gave her like an oxycodone, like 5 milligram, and she was up all night. She hated it. She's like, "This is going down the toilet. This is crap." You know, and for us, like we don't smoke, drink, or anything. So, you know, I eat a pack of M&Ms and I'm feeling hyper. You know, it's like, and for her, she's small. She hates it. We both dealt with a lot of drug stuff. I definitely want to ask you some questions from a law enforcement perspective on the drug, on the drugs in our communities and things. But I want to say something real quick. I applaud you for not using medication. I know that for some people that may be needed. I get that. But the fact that you were able to face those demons daily and, you know, intermittently without the use of drugs is really wonderful because those mind things, man, they can really mess you up.
Yeah, they scare me to death, and that's so I avoid them at all costs. In fact, I'm in a documentary, and one of the stories in there is about an officer within the drugs, and that would be a good one to look at. It's only 47 minutes, and it's on Amazon, but it's called "Is There Something Going On at Home?" And it talks about how the things at work affect our families, and it's. I'm still trying to figure out how I got involved in it, but it's an amazing. In fact, I won a bunch of awards that I had no clue. And that one, I think you can get it on Amazon for like $2.99, or you get it on. I always get it mixed up, Tubi or Fubi TV, for free, but you have to watch commercials. And that one. Talks about the things that we do and the things we see and how it affects us and that affects our families. And that's what I kind of go out and talk about now is how we can change what we do to have a positive effect instead of destroying our families. Because the divorce rate in law enforcement is like horrendously high.
We have a joke here locally. I work in the healthcare industry, and there's a joke I'll share with you just to make you laugh. That all the nurses, I work in like 20, 30 different like medical places, and all the nurses will either marry one of two people.
Copper fire.
Well, so for us, it's actually cop or drug dealer, but
Oh.
It's two opposite spectrums. I don't know why that is, but we're also a state, and I guess we're going to transition into drugs here a little bit, but we're also a state in West Virginia that you're twice as likely to die from a drug overdose as any other state in America. And
Wow.
so it's actually, there's a number, it's like 40 something to 20 something. So it's almost double, not quite double, but almost double opioid deaths per capita. So for my children, I have two kids, Isaac and Noah. One of them is 12, one of them soon to be 10. And they're frequently what they call crackheads. They're frequently, it's nothing to see people on pills and things like that. So can you tell me some stories, maybe what you dealt with as a law enforcement officer as it relates to the drug trade?
Yeah, when I was working transit, we did some stings on the
Mm-hmm.
rail system. The transit is a whole different ball game than city police because you have a whole different clientele. You have your normal everyday citizens in the city, and that could be anywhere from poor to rich to everything in between, and homeless here and there. On the transit system, it was the same thing. But you had the business people going in the morning and coming home at night, and the rest of the day was many homeless people. And many of the homeless people were homeless because of drugs. So where'd the dealers hang out? Right down on that line through where the homeless areas hung out. And it's crazy because, we'd arrest a guy, and 4 hours later, there's somebody else taking their place out dealing. There's so much money in that that people just they look at the quick fix. Well, I can get money on this, and they don't look at the results. And a lot of the people, I don't know. It's kind of, it's just scary to me. I look
Why
at
do you think the drug issue, why do you think that the drug industry or selling drugs or even addicts is such a big thing? I mean, I know that sounds like a super broad question, but it's like for me, I smoked some weed as a teenager, but I avoided the huge stuff for the most part. I party like any other teenager who is mad at the world. But being clean is so much easier.
It is. In fact, I have to laugh because my second ex-wife, her whole goal in life was for when I retired to get me high. Because
What?
I've never tried marijuana. I've never tried any drug, period. I take an aspirin maybe once or twice a year, if I'm really hurting. And
No.
that's about it. I just, like I say, the stuff scares me. And part of it's because
Fine.
I saw the homeless down there and look what they ended up. And there's homeless that are not in drugs. And there's homeless that have had really bad situations in their life that created the issue. But for the drug part of it, I can't figure it out. A lot of the people that are very, very smart that are on the street. And they're into the drugs, and I don't know why they get, but once you get hooked, it's crazy. And a lot of the getting hooked, and this is why I don't do pain meds. I've had family members that start on oxycodone and end up on heroin. And once you're hooked, that's a lifetime addiction. It's a day-to-day thing for the rest of your life. And it's so overpowering that many people just can't. If they don't have a good support system, they're probably not going to make it.
For me, like I said, I'm 33, so I was in the sixth grade in a place called Alderson, West Virginia, which had around, honestly, I don't know. You could do a quick Google search. I wouldn't be surprised if it was 2 to 5,000 people in the whole town. So my sixth grade class, quite literally, had 10 people in it. So just picture extreme small town, not even a grocery store, no red lights, nothing, right? Four people within one block of where I lived at have already died from drug-related issues within at under 33 years old, which is, in my opinion, young. My kids don't think so, but I still think so. And it is absolutely overpowered, I guess. I don't know how else to say that. When you get on them, you can't get off. You sell everything you have. Your whole life revolves around the
Rug.
acquiring that drug. Relationships mean nothing to you unless they contribute to getting those drugs. I don't know if I'm the right person to talk about how to get people off drugs, but I can definitely talk about how they have destroyed communities, and it seems like that you've definitely seen a lot of lives destroyed too.
Well, and if you've ever the worst drug for a long time was methamphetamine. And now that's, you don't even really hear about that much anymore. Now it's fentanyl. And if you ever if you ever searched a meth head's car, oh my gosh. It's just nasty. I mean, you glove and plastic bag your whole body. It's so bad. Because cleanliness means nothing. And then there's always, you find remnants of the meth, or you find syringes, and just, you know, and if you get poked, man, you got a problem. And there's so many things that are dangerous about it. Not, you know, and then you've got the standard, you know, all the porn magazines and the stuff that they got extra time, so
So
they
this,
look at it.
so from your perspective, the meth and other crimes are sort of go hand in hand.
Oh yeah. Well, if they're doing drugs, they're probably not working. And so they've got to get money somewhere, and where are they going to get the money to buy their drugs? They're going to go commit a crime to do it. And yeah, they're intertwined so tightly. It's crazy. And so if you've got that area, and then you wonder why those type of areas kind of turn into a blighted area and a down, and they get run down because that's, you know, that's where they go. That's where they hang out, and so they're ripping off their neighbors, and then they're ripping off other people, and pretty soon they're moving out, and their friends are moving in. I mean, it's a slow degradation of a whole community.
I was talking to a state police officer one time. I was managing a shoe store. So one of the requirements for that state police officer in West Virginia was that once a year he had to run like a mile or something. So he's in the place to get some shoes. It's like a basic fitness thing. So I'm asking him questions, right? Just like I'm asking you. And one of the things I asked him, he was servicing a place called Raynell, West Virginia, which is extremely bad for drugs. Zero economy, extremely bad. So just think white trailer trash, meth, that's it. Nothing else. Maybe a thrift store. Anyways, the point I'm getting at, what he said to me, what the biggest problem from his perspective was, is he said that he would go, and he was so defeated too. It was kind of sad. He said he would go and arrest a person and take them to Southern Regional Jail, which is like an hour away. It takes up his whole day. He's getting cussed out the whole time. You know, just this is just a crap day. He goes arrest him, and he would come back the next day and be canvassing the same area. There's the guy again, the same exact guy where he just get bailed out. And his opinion was that the drug problem was a product of a failed judicial system, I guess you could say.
I don't think the drug problem itself is, but they're not helping curb it at all. The judicial system, because they're not taking drugs because of the judicial system. You
That's
know,
fair.
they're already on it, and so, but yes, and nowadays, well, I mean, look at the way the world is now. It's even worse now. A lot of people, they don't even arrest them anymore. You know,
Yeah, they
especially.
just let them go. Just take the drugs off of them and just send them.
Yeah, well, and especially with the, there's a lot of anti-police sentiment, which is sad, because are there cops that make mistakes, and are there bad cops? Yes, there are. Are there cops that make mistakes, honest mistakes, trying to do the best they can? Yes, there are. But not all cops are dirty. In fact, it's probably less than 1% are dirty. But that's who gets all the news, and so everybody is now treating all cops as if they're dirty. And I hate to say it, I kind of feel like a coward saying it. I'm glad I'm out. I'm glad I'm out.
Because of the crime getting worse in the world and like the drugs getting worse.
and no support. And there's instances where officers have done the right thing and they get put in prison. And they really didn't have a whole lot of choice. But so now it's that's one reason there's less and less officers. I mean, I just read an article the other day, and LA is down 5,000 officers. Two thousand. They wanted 10,000, and they're at like 7,500 or something like that. When you're in a big city like that. Help. And then you go watch the videos from 2 years ago or 3 years ago up there where they're burning Seattle and Minneapolis, and
there's no real good way to go in there because you're looking at people destroying property, committing heinous crimes. I'm not a law enforcement officer, but I see sort of the marketing behind it. It's like, okay, these people are doing a bunch of crimes disguised as a civil rights protest, which it's not. It's
and they're
not.
Selling them as heroes.
Yeah. And so the cop is automatically the bad guy as soon as he goes. And then they get the video. He's like, there's this cop, he's tackling some kid who's smashing car windows, trying to get him detained. And all you see is a person of some minority or whatever getting tackled by a cop. And then it's marketed by the media, basically, as a hate crime.
Yep.
So now the cop's doing his job, but now he has to face not only the media, then he's probably going to get investigated by his department or something. Yep. And there's just a whole bunch of bullcrap. And if I was a cop, I'm like, dude, I'm not doing that. Why would I want to do that?
Well, and that's what's happening now is, in fact, what was funny was Minneapolis was short officers because everybody left. Because a lot of them were getting beat up like you just described. And now they're offering like $100,000, $200,000 bonuses to hire on, but nobody will go work for them. Because the administration doesn't back the officers. And when I say back the officers, I don't mean let them do whatever they want. That's not what I mean at all. Because there are standards and there are policies and there are things to prevent those things from happening. Now, yeah, I'm not sure I would become an officer today. I probably would, but.
My opinion is that with body cam footage now, you're able to see the full story. So
yeah.
I think that the media outlets that edit these videos to only show certain parts of an interaction should be held liable for suit, for getting sued.
And they should be, but everybody's afraid to. Because
if they don't show the bigger picture, if somebody's doing something wrong, if a law enforcement officer was in the wrong, then he should definitely be reprimanded because he's given the trust of that that county, that town, that state. Those taxpayers are paying his salary more than likely, and I understand that part of it, but at the same time, it's kind of like unless you have the full story, which 90% of the time you don't, it's not fair. It's just not fair.
Well, and that's the thing. They need to present the whole story. They present what they want. And a lot of times it makes it more dramatic or makes it more controversial. And that's what sells. And it's all about the dollar.
I got a couple more questions to ask you here. I'm not sure even how long we've been on here for, but it's been awesome. This has went really good and organically. One question. Like I said before, I'm kind of working on a larger project when it comes to poverty. And from you being a law enforcement specialist, expert, however you want to put that, would you agree that people that are in poverty commit more crimes than the middle class or higher class? Is that something that you experience?
Actually, that's an interesting question because I had an experience once. I was taking a guy to jail. He'd ripped off a grocery store for hundreds of dollars of food and was trying to peddle it out. And then he had felony warrants, so I had to take him to jail. But as I'm on the way to jail, I says, "Why did you do this?" And he says, "Well, I need to feed my kids." Okay. Now, is that a feeding your kids? Is that a good thing?
No.
Oh
No.
yeah,
I mean,
feeding your kids is a good thing. But I told him, I says, well, you could have gone, and I gave him some choices of places he could have got food for free that he didn't know about.
Food pantries or whatever. Sure.
What I discovered is lack of money leads to lack of opportunity. And so this guy had a basically barely got out of junior high, maybe a sophomore in high school education. So lack of education also leads to lack of opportunity. He could barely read, so he did not know about these things. And once he learned, I told him about him. He went, "Oh, So lack of money and education leads to lack of opportunity, and lack of opportunity leads to issues, and so leads to lack of choices. And the lack of choices are because he was not aware. So poverty is a huge problem. And unfortunately, our government feeds it a lot. I hate the welfare system. It's run totally wrong because they're paying people to do nothing, which is kind of what I think is the back burner of what some people want, because it creates a class of, I wouldn't even say worker bees, because a lot of them don't even work, but of people that need them. And so it's kind of a power thing. Is there more crime in poverty areas? Not necessarily so. I think a lot of the other crimes are just hidden better because people are educated, they have more world experience. And that was the other thing. Lack of money leads to lack of experience, lack of world experience. Like many of these people have never traveled outside their neighborhood, let alone another state, let alone another country. And as you see more of these things, I got lucky. I grew up in a small farm town. And I never, the only reason I got out of town was I was on athletic teams. And so we travel. The closest town was 40 miles away, and the next closest town was 90 miles away. And so I got to see some things through that woke me up. And my parents were very, very demanding on education. And so I have a college degree. That's a whole nother story. But that led to some other things that I learned to do. And then I was able to work that into traveling to some places that I never even dreamed of going when I was growing up. I never even heard of them. But then all of a sudden I got to see some of these things, and it was like, holy cow, the world's this big. It's huge. And it's not just whereas poverty, your world's that maybe, especially in the cities, maybe that block you're on, or that little town you're in, and you don't see anything else. And that just totally leads to again, almost isolation.
And I agree 100%. I'll give you just some. I grew up in extreme poverty. My mom, we basically, five of us, my dad didn't work. My two sisters, we all grew up on my mom's disability check, you know. So I can remember when food stamps were coupon books, you know. And I knew where food pantries was. I got my toys from Salvation Army free little cardboard boxes. I definitely know the poverty, and I guess that's why I'm working on a larger thing. And to your point, as it relates to travel, when I really started noticing that my life was wrong, I had an eighth grade education. I'd never left the East Coast. Now, being college educated, and I've traveled the world more or less. I'm going to Egypt in April. You start seeing some things that you didn't realize were the case. And that's, again, with the poverty thing, I know that's sort of outside of the law enforcement, but it kind of isn't. I've seen poverty on a different scale internationally. I've been on the other side of the West Bank wall in Palestine. I've been there, you know. I've been to some really nasty streets in New Orleans, which is pretty much its own country compared to West Virginia. I've seen Canada was pretty clean. I've been through Mexico City and saw the military police there and some of those ghettos there. And the thing that I've noticed is poverty is different when it comes to different cultures. But the thing that I have a really tough time, and this isn't going to be fair, it's going to be kind of controversial what I'm about to say, is in America, we still have opportunity. And it's like, okay, well, you're in poverty. I get that poverty is really hard to get out of. I get that a life of crime is really hard to stop. But you live in a country that provides you opportunity to do things. And it's not always easy. But there's other places in this world that has no opportunity because of their status on a world stage. So
Where else in the world does the poor have a $600 cell phone? Where else in the world does the poor, if they, I mean, there's opportunities to go get things you need here if you're poor, whereas in Africa or in the Middle East or other, even in South America, you're poor. You may not have food for days. I mean, in here, that's just not even dreamed of. And that's, I kind of laugh. I don't laugh because being poor here is not poor anywhere else in the world. And that's one reason you have a lot of the world's poor wanting to come here. Because like say, there are opportunities if you will work hard enough to get them. And a lot of times we make that difficult on ourselves. I know I did. I got to college and I learned about girls and alcohol, and I lasted 3 years before my GPA dropped from a 3.9 to a 1.9, and I was out. But I went back 7 years later and I pulled straight A's to get the GPA, and I did it. But you know, those are things I screwed up the first opportunity. And then I was able to take advantage of the second.
I like the idea of how I did it when it comes to college. I went to college at 30, in my 30s here. I got to, like I said before, I'm a senior at a Christian college. I should graduate in May unless this accounting class keeps kicking my butt, but
That one.
I had a 4.0 up until this last semester, and then I have a feeling that I'm going to get my first B here. So, but I was more prepared mentally. A lot of people don't know this. Men's brains aren't even fully developed until they're 25. So coming into it, a little bit later in life, I think was the way to go. And I was in a lot less debt from doing so. Mr. Williams, I'm going to start thinking about wrapping this up. I wanted to tell you how much I appreciate you coming on. This conversation was really good. And I kind of need a guy that has some law enforcement background as it relates to current events that maybe later on you could get back on, possibly if you'd be willing to.
Oh,
That's totally up to
absolutely.
you. And
Absolutely.
I could send you an email or something. Of course, I'll give you plenty of time to plug your book or websites, anything like that. And, but as it relates to the poverty question, there's going to be a lot more conversations that are needed that I think a law enforcement professional could really give some good insight to from that analysis. And like I said, I'm trying to bring enough people together to work on a larger project. I'm thinking a documentary of some sort, or maybe even writing my own book. I'll finish up here the last 5 or 10 minutes here talking about your book. Obviously, you said that it was available on what platforms?
It's on Barnes and Noble and Amazon, and I know there's a couple others. I heard Kmart, you can order it from them, which I did not know that. Yeah, it's available. And like I say, it just talks about a lot of the mistakes I made, the things that created my PTSD and how I didn't work it and how I would do it differently now. And then it gives tips, hints, and suggestions on things that worked for me that might help you.
Awesome. And just a couple last questions as it relates to the book. You wrote the book yourself. You said
Yes.
that you're a pretty good writer. So what did that look like as far as finding a publisher and getting that distributed? What kind of money was there involved on your part, etc.?
That's a tough part because I've got my fiction series that I'm coming out with, and I'm still trying to find a a publisher. I went with a hybrid publisher the first time, and they did a really good job. But no matter who you go with, the marketing is all on you.
That's
You know,
interesting.
yeah, I and that's where. So I've done book signings all over the country, and you know, I can't even name all the places, and it's been a blast because I love meeting people. But yeah, it's a lot of work, and the writing's actually the easy part.
So as it relates to the book signings and things like that, has the book been pretty successful since you wrote it? Have you sold enough copies for it to make sense financially?
No, I have
I
not. But
love the realness of this conversation. It's
yeah,
so awesome.
no, I have not sold as many, but part of that is I actually sell more at conferences and in classes than I have in bookstores. And I go to conferences, you know, a couple a year, and when I teach my classes, like I'm scheduled to teach up in Illinois on March 4th and in St. Louis on March 6th. And so I'll have a box of my books and I'll sell some there. But
How did you get involved in doing conferences? Is that something that you just had contacts with, or?
well, when I went through my process and the healing that I did, I came, you know what? Everybody's going through this. Because I go to police departments still and they're all the same. You know, they've got their individualities, but the results are the same, and the divorce rate's so high that, man, I'm gonna help people change this. So my goal in life right now is if I can help one person not do the stupid stuff that I did and save our relationship, then we all win. And in
Absolutely.
fact, I've talked to hospitals, I've talked with police departments, fire departments, haven't done any military yet. But I wrote a course, I have an 8-hour class called Bridging the Gap that I teach. And I include the documentary in it because it's a 47-minute documentary. And I talk about the things that I experienced. And I ask a lot of questions in the class because there are a lot of similarities in officers. And I see guys doing the same stupid stuff I did.
I
Because
think it takes a certain type of person to even consider being a law enforcement officer, but so maybe that's where you get some of the correlation with the career and the personality type.
A lot of really type A or high B type A type people, you know, because you got to be a go-getter. And once you and you have to want to make a difference. That's the people that do the good job is they want to make a difference. They aren't there for their stupid ego. And but then you get those people in there too. And unfortunately, what I've discovered is trauma comes in three aspects, in my opinion. You have your experiential trauma. That's the experiences that create the trauma. You have relationship trauma, because my second wife actually hated cops. And then you have and then you have leadership trauma. Because you have people that aren't leaders that create more trauma than they solve. The one guy 18 years in, he was a leader and he helped reduce trauma for me. Whereas I've had other leaders that created more trauma than they was necessary. And so those are the I break it into those. And again, I'm not a doctor. That's my experience in life. I've broken it into.
I'm going to give you the last word. I'll ask you a last question here, and then I've got a whole notebook of notes here that I've written during the course of the time. If you had to give advice for people to get out of PTSD, how would you tell them to get out of PTSD? How do they defeat that demon, I guess?
Yeah, you're not going to get out of it, but you can work through it and work with it. And the best way is to start talking. In fact, write things down. That's a good way to let your mind know it's okay to let it out, because many of us don't want to let it out. And I've discovered that the reason we don't want to let it out is not because we're afraid to share it so much, but we don't want to relive it. And that's looking in hindsight, I realize that now. I didn't realize it at the time. And so make sure and talk, keep communications open with a professional or a friend or anybody that you won't affect their life negatively with, and work through it in that manner. By writing it down, that helps get it out and let your mind know it's okay. And that makes it easier to talk about it in the future. I'll be honest, that's a lot of what happened with my book, is I put stuff in there and all of a sudden I went, oh. And I started talking to my wife about it, my wife now. We had just been married when I wrote my book, and we, like I say, we have no secrets. She knows everything.
That's awesome. Being honest and open communication, something that you have repeated and repeated during this episode. And it sounds like some really sound advice. So I'm going to help you out with the marketing. Everybody who listens to this, I highly recommend Bridging the Gap. He has repeated where it is available at, especially Amazon. That's a safe place to buy. A couple lasting quotes. I'm a big quote guy. My phone has 5,000 photos of quotes and like 20 photos of my kids. I'm kidding. But anyways, let me see here. Which ones do I want to go with? This is one of the ones that you mentioned was, there's no excuses, just choices.
Yeah.
No excuses, just choices. The choices you make are what you're going to be responsible for. Another one that is, I'm hoping I don't butcher this, lack of money leads to lack of opportunity. Lack of education leads to a lack of opportunity. I really like that one. And I'll probably end up quoting that on the larger project. Mr. Williams, if you wouldn't mind, after we conclude this call here in the next 30 to 90 seconds, email me and send me pictures of your book.
Okay.
And then a picture of yourself. I like to do a little slideshow at the end or even at the beginning, and that'll help highlight and bring more awareness to your book, your story. And I'll also follow up more than likely after I get back from Egypt. That'll be in April, with maybe a follow-up episode if you're still willing. And I'll have a whole bunch more questions. And like I said, I really appreciate your time. You're awesome. And way to go on. I cannot even imagine what those 3 years like was, or those 3 years was like in isolation, drinking, dealing with those demons. That's, I've seen that go a totally different direction so many times. And but you defeated it. So,
you know, it's an amazing life that I have now, and I'm just creating more and more things, and that's what I love about it as we move forward. In fact, I went through West Virginia about 6 weeks ago, so 8 weeks ago.
Really? What area?
I can't remember. I was pulling my fifth wheel through.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And, well, you mentioned nature was healing, so I almost cut you off there back. And when you mentioned that a little bit ago and said, welcome to West Virginia, we have counties all the way around us that literally hold counties that do not have a red light or a fast food restaurant. So
we went through that area. It's up kind of almost in the mountains a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a beautiful area. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. West Virginia has a lot of nature to do. The problem with West Virginia, and it's one of the most impoverished places. Healthcare, bottom two or three. Opioid addiction, almost double the national rate of any other state. The education is one of the worst in the country. And the problem for me is, and this is going to touch base on the whole thing, bigger project I got going on, but the towns are cut off. So you go up mountains. So for instance, my wife, when she had to have surgeries, the surgery I spoke of last week or week before, we had to drive 3.5 hours for that. So when she was going through chemo and all that stuff, we put 50,000 miles on a brand new vehicle in 1 year.
Wow.
So everything's cut off. You don't have access to things. Thank God for the internet, right? Yeah. But we kind of live in a bubble here, but for a nature perspective, it's definitely recommended from a job or economy or healthcare or education perspective. it's not a good place to be. I'm just being honest about it. But we have some good law enforcement officers here, that's for sure.
Good, good. I love to hear that. Yeah, I feel your pain. I had last year two daughters in two separate states with cancer.
We're going to definitely have to do a follow-up episode. We'll be here for another hour, but I got to ask the question. What kind of cancer did they deal with?
one of them in Colorado had breast cancer, and the other one had in North Carolina, that's why we were driving out, was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
We're definitely going to have to do another episode. This is getting into the realm of something that we could do another 3 hours on. Could I ask what kind of breast cancer she had?
That I don't know. They're my stepdaughters, actually,
Okay. Yeah.
but I can't remember all the details on that. I'd have to get my wife.
Sure.
And then, and my actually, my first wife died of cancer.
You're an interesting fellow, Mr. Williams. I tell you, it sounds like me and you have a lot of things in common when it relates to just a crazy background. I watched my dad die. We lived in a van homeless, went through two house fires.
Wow.
My wife, we had a when my wife and I first started dating, she had a bed that you could feel the rats crawling in. And you could feel them on your back. I swear on everything I love. And my wife would catch them. She thought it was funny. I still think it's weird. I've never been so poor that I thought that that was normal behavior. But anyways, my point is that after a while, when you go through so many things in life, you start thinking that you're cursed. That was my experience. And it definitely sounds like you've just had things over and over and over and over again. And
Now,
cancer is a big subject.
I've been pretty lucky, but I don't look at things like I said, I don't look at good and bad anymore. I learn look at them as opportunities now. Because if I do something that doesn't work and I learn from it, then it's not bad.
Sure.
If I learn from it and move on and do something better and better, then that's all we can do is just keep doing the best we can.
Moving forward.
And I look forward to, well, I don't look forward to, because I was told when I grew up, I got diabetes when I was 15. And that was, I was told, my family was told, they didn't tell me till a couple years ago, that I would be lucky to live to be 40. So now I'm going to live to be 95 just to piss them off and prove them wrong.
My great grandmother is 90 and she still drives and lives herself, and she's still kicking. I don't know how. I got some funny videos on the YouTube channel, same name, the Adwell podcast, of me just asking her the most ridiculously stupid questions in the world, and just getting her reaction just to see. But she lived, really late in life, and I actually had a friend talking about drugs and diabetes. I actually had a friend who had gotten diabetes in the 7th grade, and basically he had to use a needle for something, maybe for insulin or something, very young. It turned into a he turned into a meth addiction later on in life. He got on drugs and he was just so used to using that needle. And he actually, to get off drugs and get clean, he actually left the entire state, left every relationship, moved away, found him a woman, and from the last I heard, he's clean and healthy and things. So, again, with the relationships, those are extremely important.
Sometimes that's what we have to do, because that's what I did. I drank my way out of college, partied my way out of college. I mean, I had a hell of a time. I rodeoed, rode bareback broncs, walked on and played baseball. I joined two frats so I could party twice as much. And I finally, when I got told I was going to be put on probation, I went, okay, and I just dropped out, packed my car up, and I moved to Utah. And I didn't know anybody, but it was a good choice. And those that's yeah, sometimes that's what you have to do is just get a
Start
little,
over. Get away and start over. One last question, and then I'm going to cut it because we've done cut it like three times, and I keep on like you just I just keep on like I my wife will tell you I can talk forever. I can promise. This is my calling is podcast because my kids call it yap. That's all I do is yap. But so I'm kind of new at doing this whole podcast thing. So you've been on several podcasts. How have I done personally? Have I done okay?
This is the type of podcast I like where some of them are very formal and you just ask questions and you answer the questions. I like the conversation part, so you're doing great.
Yeah, I like to correlate stories. It's just the way my mind works. I like to think, like when someone brings up something, I like to say, okay, well, what story in my life can be could add to the conversation here instead of just I saw this one guy, he was doing the podcast, he would go down a list with all these questions. As soon as the person would answer, he'd say, okay, that's interesting. And then he'd ask another question. And I'm like, man, you're killing the whole flow of this whole thing, you know?
Yeah,
But
and that's what you're doing well is let it flow. And also do that when you write your book.
yeah, that's
Because what
interesting.
I've discovered, especially in teaching, is because I found out I'm a good trainer. I love to train. In fact, man, I'd come out and talk to any of your guys' police departments or your hospitals out there. And I found out I'm actually pretty good at it. But you always give the facts and give what you where you want to go, but then have follow in with a story or a an example, and that brings it to life for people.
I have something on my desk here. I'll share. It's what this is the Aristotle rhetorical triangle. And basically what it is you got to be credible. So you got to be telling the truth about what you're doing, right? You got to be logical. It's got to make sense to the audience or to your listener or your person. And you got to connect. So that's always on my desk. I'm just trying to figure this thing out. It may not, honestly, I haven't made a penny off this thing yet. It may not ever make any money, but it's interesting to talk to really awesome people. So,
Well, and you're expanding your horizons by doing this as well as us expanding ours.
sure. Yeah.
So that, that it's all got to be an intermix of and good for both.
Awesome. Alrighty, Mr. Williams. I will follow up an email. I hope you have a good rest of your day, sir, and I appreciate you being on.
Well, thank you, Randy. I appreciate it. And look forward to getting with you again.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye.